There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Today, we're going to be discussing what comes along with the aging process. We're going to be talking about the five stages of aging. What is a midlife crisis? How do we change physically, but also mentally? And it's not all that bad, I promise. And is 50 perhaps the new 30? Well, we've got two great experts who are going to be joining us. We're going to have a chat with Keith O'Malley-Farrell from the Physical Training Company, and also Dr. Thraya Kanafani, who's Clinical Director, Clinical Psychologist, and co-owner of the Human Relations Institutes and Clinics. And so please do join the conversation with your questions. Give us a shout if it is your birthday today, or if it's coming up. How are you going to spend it? Will you be commiserating, or will you be celebrating? 4001 is our text message number. You can also join us live on the line on 43 1010. Do keep those numbers handy as well, because we've got a number of competitions we're going to be getting through throughout the next 2 hours as well. So let's say hello and welcome to, first of all, Dr. Thraya. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
How are you feeling?
Happy birthday.
Thank you. You've been not very well, so it's,
no, I haven't. I apologize for the voice, but I'll do my best to not sound too much like a duck today.
And thank you to Keith O'Malley-Farrell. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Feeling young, fit, and healthy.
As best I can be, yeah.
Well, let's try and keep that the mood throughout the next 2 hours. I don't know quite how I'm feeling about being another year older, actually. I suppose it is always a time of contemplation. It's a day when, as you get older, as I certainly am in my later years, that you do start thinking about a lot more different things. I think it's less of a celebration, more of a contemplation. So this is what we're going to be talking about, more of the physical side with Keith, more of the mental and psychological side with Dr. Thraya. Perhaps we'll start with you, Dr. Thraya. You brought some fantastic notes and thoughts and ideas with you today. A lot about, you know, what is a midlife crisis? What are the different stages of that? How do we recognize it? Perhaps we can start with that if you'd like to.
Yes, of course. So when we talk about midlife crisis, usually the ages that begins is around the age of 40, and it can last anywhere up until the age of 60. Now, usually when you think of it, it's more like a mindset, because there is about a 20-year gap there. The idea is more of, you know, usually before the age of 30, the 40, you sort of think of your life from birth to where you are, versus around the time of the midlife crisis, you start to think of the life you have left rather than the life you have been living. And so that's where that mindset starts to change between, you know, the life I'm living to the life I have left. And in general, there are stages. There are six stages, and usually they're very much actually similar to the stages of grief.
Grief, yes.
If you really think about it, they're actually the exact same stages of grief, except there's one that's a little bit different, which is called replay, which is actually stage three. So starting from the beginning, you have stage one, which is the idea of this denial, where, you know, you really start to push away or resist the fact that you're getting older. You don't really think of, you know, I think Keith can talk about a little bit later in terms of our physical changes that happen and our abilities that change as well. So you really start to push that, you resist those thoughts. And then moving on into stage two, which is that anger. Once that reality starts to kick in, you start to recognize that these things are actually happening and you can't really stop them. So there's that frustration, that irritation that kicks in. Then stage three is replay, where you start to, what we call, regress into your earlier years. You start to go clubbing when you stop clubbing for the past 20 years, for instance, where you start to hang out with...
I don't think that's going to happen to me.
You start to hang out with individuals who, you know, like, do things that you used to do in your 20s, but you really want to start reliving. So it's not that you are enjoying life differently. It's just that you start to go back. You regress into an earlier stage in your life, almost like you're resisting moving forward. Stage four is usually around that depressive state, where you start to recognize that, okay, this is it. This is where I'm at, you know, and I have to really push myself moving forward. And then you start moving into the, well, if I do this, then maybe I can look younger or feel younger or be younger. And then finally, you get to the acceptance stage, where you recognize that, you know, this is a part of life. It's transition. Doesn't necessarily have to be a crisis, like we were discussing earlier. And then once the acceptance stage kicks in, you start to accept it a little bit more, obviously, and feel a lot better in the stage that you're in, and look forward to how you can make this a part of your life rather than something that you're resisting so much.
And it's interesting. I think it might have been you, but you were talking about these stages, which you said were very much like the stages of grief, but that you can go backwards and forwards within these stages as well. It doesn't mean it's linear and you just go straight through to the end, which is acceptance.
Absolutely. I mean, with any kind of cycle, if you will, it's not really linear. You have to sort of go back and forth. And sometimes you will jump into, people might deny in the beginning and then fully accept it. And then work through once they start to look around them, or, you know, sometimes as people get older, they start to rethink their own existence, their mortality. And so that takes them back and they start to go into more anger and replay and then depression. So absolutely, this is more of a cycle, and it can definitely, you know, once you get to acceptance, you can actually go back all the way to the beginning once all of this happens. So it really depends on the person, but it depends more on the mindset that you hold with the idea of getting older.
And we could perhaps go into a lot more detail about those various different stages as well, those six stages. The denial stage, as you mentioned, that is obviously you just don't want to get any older. You want to stay where you are. You're not happy with the changes that are happening in your life. You're not happy with the physical, perhaps the mental changes. Is this the stage where you might decide to wear younger clothes or go out, as you said, go out clubbing and these sorts of things?
The replay stage.
Oh, that's when you go back.
That's when you go back. The denial stage is just truly denying any kind of step forwards in your life. So things like, for instance, you know, as you get older, your body changes, and the things that you can eat changes, the amount that you drink coffee, for instance, can change. And so things start to affect you more as you get older. And thus, sometimes in that denial stage, you just refuse to accept it, and you continue to behave in the same way, harming your body more than helping it.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Perhaps we can bring Keith in at that point as well. I mean, not so much on the food side, but, you know, there are certain more nutrients that you need when you get older. Perhaps for women, you need to start taking more calcium, or just eating healthier, looking after yourself a bit more. You don't necessarily have to, but if you want to look better as you age and age better, then that's probably what you should be thinking about. I mean, on the physical side, Keith, are there a lot of changes that you need to think about if you are already active as you get older?
If you're already active, I mean, there comes a point where there's nothing you can do about the aging process. You're gonna begin to get older. Like, your cells are gonna begin to just stop multiplying, stop dividing. The rate at which that happens, you can control, or you can prolong, rather. So, when you're young and you're fit and you're healthy, you've got the world is your oyster. You're doing all your sports, you're doing all your activities, you're eating what you want. I'd say part of the denial phase is kind of like where people think, oh, it'll never be me. You know, I'll never be 50, and I'll never be overweight, and I'll never have a bad back. I'll always be in the gym. Yeah. Or I'll always be able to go on the bike. So yeah, I'll just keep doing sort of exactly how I was doing when I was in my 20s. And then without knowing, the slowly but surely the aging process is just creeping up on them, kind of inherently under the surface, that when they hurt their back, things get thrown off out of sync, and now they have to really accept almost that, right, you're a little bit older, we need to not maybe put so much weight on the bar or not run a marathon a week.
Yeah, they say that unfortunately it can take something like that, either something tragic to happen in your own life, it could be a death in your family, or it could be an accident of sorts that really starts to make you think about your own mortality and about your own life, and especially if you injure your back. I mean, your whole life, just, you know, everything is connected, isn't it? So it merely makes you appreciate your health.
Yeah, I mean, sort of the more you go through your day, you've got your little routine where everything fits in the right place in your day. Like, now you've got a back pain, now you can't maybe help the kids as much, or you can't quickly get into the car as much. Now you're running a little bit late for work, you can't do your job, your mood is a little bit lower, you get a little bit more irate when you're trying to speak to people, and you don't know where to go to fix this back because you've never had a back injury before. You've never had to actually accept that you've got now you've got a weakness that's really affecting your life.
So there's the denial stage and sort of overcoming that. And what some of the transitions, we spoke about crisis, when really we want to sort of move that concept not to a crisis but into a transition. It's a much better way of thinking about it, isn't it? So in the denial stage, how would you change the denial crisis, let's say, into a transition of a positive transition?
Well, you know, it goes back to a little bit what Keith was saying, is that idea of, you know, accepting the fact that this is part of life. Like, we all get older, we all transition, we all become 50, our bodies start to change. And so moving past the denial is not necessarily fully accepting what's happening to you, but really recognizing that these things, as soon as you start to feel them, not to just reject them and pretend that they're not existing, because that could lead to a lot, obviously, a lot more difficulties for you later. So working through that is really, it's just, at least for the first step, is the recognition that this has to happen to you as well, just like everybody else.
And would people do that when they're 20s, 30s? I mean, you said it's usually when you're in your 40s, but I suppose, you know, you think about, people think about it at very different stages in their lives. It could be at 20.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Like an early life crisis at 20.
They have thought of the quarter life crisis now, which happens around 25. And that is usually for individuals who are more, they graduate, they don't know what to do with their life, they don't know what job to get into. So that's what they are usually defining as a quarter life crisis. But what usually happens with individuals before the age of 40 is that they're looking forward to getting older. So those in their 20s are like, we want to be 25 because people will look at us differently, or we'll be more respected, or we can do this. Or especially those that are, you know, in the teens, they want to get older, become 18, or they want to be 21. And then you get to around 40 and you're like, no, wait a second, I want to go back. So this is where that, you know, like mentioned earlier, it's that difference in mindset between looking forward to getting older versus now thinking about the mortality of your life and how much time do I have left.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was another article talking about the seasons of life theory, which I thought was quite good. It was identified stages and growth that occur well into the adult years. And it was Levinson, he's a psychologist, Daniel Levinson. His theory is comprised of sequence-like stages, and each stage is shaped by an event or action that leads into the next stage. And there are, I think, seven different stages. Early adult transition. I don't know, would you like to talk us through these? I'm being pointed at, I don't know.
I think,
1 minute.
I mean, well, Levinson's seasons of any male, it's more a male's life than it is a female's life, but these stages are very much similar to the other stages. However, the one thing that he really looks into is the mindset that you carry with it. Mm. So it's not just about being old versus being young. It's also about being destructive versus constructive in the way that you think about things. It's about the idea of understanding your gender role and your role, not just as an individual growing up, but also your role moving forward and giving back and learning what you want to leave behind. So the stages are, yes, in terms of how you get through it, but it's also in terms of what will you do in order to alleviate a lot of what we call the crisis of the midlife stage.
Mm. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self? We'd love to hear from you. What would you give to? What advice would you give, Dr. Thoraya? Put you on the spot there. I'll go to Kiko while you're thinking.
I wasn't thinking about that either. I don't know.
I think I'd always say, don't be so stressed out about life, actually. It's not that stressful.
Actually, yes. Maybe I would say, like,
enjoy
a break.
Enjoy it. Yeah, take a break.
Or slow down, maybe. Yeah. I think that would be my advice to myself, 20. At 20, to say, just slow down.
They did. I don't know if you saw it. I know a lot of people did, but there was I think it was a documentary. I think it was based in the UK, but they went into, I think it was a hospice, and they spoke to a number of nurses there who were working. And they did this documentary, and they spoke to the nurses. And the nurses obviously spent a lot of time with these people who were terminally ill for various different reasons. And the number one thing that they said that they all were sad about or regretted was that they didn't spend enough time with their family. That was the number one thing. It was really interesting. Not that they weren't successful enough, or, you know, they didn't earn enough money, or they didn't travel enough, or any of these things. The number one thing in that particular hospice, in that particular case, was that they didn't feel that they spent enough time with their family, amongst their loved ones, being loved and sharing love, which I thought that was quite interesting.
You know, actually, that that sort of is very symbolic in general when it comes to regret as you get older. A lot of the clients that I see, their biggest regrets are more things that they haven't done rather than it is things that they have done and then maybe not necessarily succeeded in.
Yeah.
So, and that would be exactly the same as that. Like, you know, not spending time with your family, not doing something that you've always wanted to do. I think that's also where... that transition of midlife crisis might come into is that the idea of, have I done the things that I've wanted to do, and what has actually stopped me? Was it myself or was it something else in my life?
Got a great message come through, actually. Thank you for that. No name, and it was saying, advice to my 20-year-old self is to buy Bitcoin. Yeah, but make sure you got out at the right time as well, if you can. Yeah, it's interesting. There's, I was reading this article and they're saying that when you're 20, you say you don't care what other people think about you. When you're 30, you actually don't care what other people think about you. Sorry, you do care. Let me repeat that. When you're 20, you say you don't care what other people think about you. When you're 30, you actually don't care what people think about you. And when you're 40, you finally understand that nobody is thinking about you. So it goes back to that thing about regrets, that actually... doesn't really matter anyway, because most people will have forgotten or probably not really thought about it too much anyway. It will be you that will have perhaps carried on that that guilt or that, you know, that whatever it is with you through the years. But you know, going through those transitions can always be quite tricky, and I think looking back, as you mentioned, people are looking back on their lives and what they could have done and what they should have done. Do you think it's a good idea to write a bucket list then? When you're younger?
Well, I like to promote what I do as well, not be hypocritical, but I have a bucket list myself, and I think bucket lists are great ways, is a great way to actually motivate yourself to look forward, not just, you know, think of, you know, oh no, like my time is running out, rather than saying, okay, I still have time to do this and I still have time to do that. So it's just about reframing your life and looking at it from a different perspective. So bucket lists are a great idea, a great strategy.
And you have one?
Actually, I do.
Are you ticking them off?
I am, slowly. I currently have 68 things on my bucket list.
How many did you start with?
I started with about 14. Now I'm at 68 of things that I want to do. I haven't completed all 68, but I think I'm around 30 in.
I have one as well.
Do you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's important in one sense just to have a little bit of ambition. You know, this is just what I want to do, and what am I going to spend my future doing? But then you have to sort of grasp an opportunity. So, okay, so you want to travel somewhere. There's a friend of yours going that place. That's an opportunity to go and do it. So if that's not enough, you've got it on your bucket list. You want to tick it off. And you can begin to kind of shape your life based around... It sounds quite arbitrary, but it's almost like a list of goals. It's just got this kind of glam name of a bucket list. But it's just a list of goals of what you want to achieve. Whether it's you put an amount of money you want to earn every year, or a certain weight you want to be, or a certain way you want to look. It's on the list. This is my life is shaping towards this. And I'm not going to go in order 1, 2, 3. But I know that, oh, that's the thing I wanted to do. Let me try and grasp the best opportunity I can to achieve it.
But you have to keep revisiting that bucket list as well, because it's fine to write those New Year's resolutions. We are in February, and I'm sure many people did write them, you know, the 1st of January or before. And there's no point putting that list away, is there, and then going back the whole year and then going back and going, oh, oops, I didn't actually do any of those. It's got to be an ongoing thing that you continuously revisit, that you continuously either challenge yourself and look towards to see if you can, you know, and set targets.
I think a big part of that has to do with changing your strategy, because usually at the beginning of every year, people write down, or they might not necessarily write down their goals, but they think about their goals. They say, this year, you know, I'm going to quit smoking, I'm going to like work out more, I'm going to eat healthy, whatever it is that they decide on, but they don't actually have an action plan for it. They just sort of set a very abstract goal. Now, the difference with a bucket list is more that it's usually a very specific thing. So it's more like I want to target this, or I want to do this, or I want to go here. And so what ends up happening is that you start to plan it. Once it's put on paper, it's almost like it really motivates you. It gets you to say to yourself, it's on paper. I need to check that off my list right now.
What's one of your, can I ask you what one of your big things
sure.
is?
Sure. that I haven't completed
yes.
or have?
Both. Tell
so,
us one of the
other. Have, I think one of my biggest ones so far was achieving my PhD and owning my own center. That was really important for
That's
me.
That's a big one. Yeah.
One I haven't, and it's taking me forever, is writing a book.
Gosh. Okay.
So that's going to take me quite some time, I think.
What about you, Keith?
The one that I probably wrote down that I never thought I would get to do was I wanted to drive a tank. But then, that was when I was in my early...
I was going to say, was that when... Oh, go.
Yeah, I was in my early 20s, just boom, boom, boom. I want to drive a tank.
I love that.
Well, having no... I've never been anywhere near a military. And then in my mid-20s, I got a job working for the British military, rehabbing guys, and still nowhere near the tank people in the army. And then someone said to me, here, do you want to go down to the tank yard? Have a look. I said, yeah, I'll go down and have a look. And then I was like, I know this is on my bucket list. This is the only chance my whole life I'm going to get a chance to get into a tank and, like... I don't know how you drive it, but hopefully he'll tell me. So I just kept pushing him. Can I drive one? And you're not allowed really drive one, yeah, because it's not a key ignition and a pedal. It's 100 levers and there's multiple people. And I'm actually too tall to sit in the driver's seat on the front of the tank. But the best thing I could do was to move the turret with the gun thing while the other guy drove. And we literally just did it about 2 meters up the track in the yard between the garages.
Right.
But... that was, got home, opened the laptop, tick.
Amazing.
Really happy with that.
And what's the one that you haven't yet achieved that you really want to?
Probably, I do actually have write a book on it as well, but I don't even know what I would talk about.
Yeah, but it's on there.
Yeah, it'll be maybe a children's or a comic book. But if I'm too old and it's not done yet, something very simple.
Well, I'd love to hear them. We'd love to hear yours as well. Why not text in 4001? We've got loads more come through. We'd love to hear from you. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self? And you'll go into the draw to win 2 tickets. We're talking all about aging today, what it means to get old. What are some of the transitions that you might go through? We're also been asking you a couple of questions as well, because we have a competition running throughout the programme to win 2 tickets off to Taste of Dubai. And so we were asking you, just text in your name, Taste of Dubai, to 4001 via the Dubai iMessenger app, and tell us what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self. And we've also got another competition. We're going to keep with the same question, actually, going. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old old self? But this one is to also win a voucher for a week at an ESM holiday camp. And this is courtesy of Jumeirah Primary School. So Jumeirah Primary School is established in the ESM, these are the camps, were established in 2004. And they're the UAE's leading sports service provider for children, adults and the community. So... but let's not get this confused now. You've got two competitions. The second one, just text in JPS, again, to 4001. The first one is to win tickets to Taste of Dubai. But the same question for both. What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self? I think let's go through some of those messages now, because they're quite interesting. We've also been asking our guests here in the studio. Let's see what we've got. Obeid, he says, his advice would be to not take life for granted and actually work towards a future and not live in the moment, because life will catch up at some point and you will have to force yourself to sort stuff out. So it's better to be sooner than later. No regrets, though. It's part of the journey. 39 and glowing. Thanks very much, Obeid. Yeah. So don't take your life for granted, but actually work towards a future and not live in the moment. What do you think about that, Dr. Thuraya?
I mean, I like the idea of planning for the future, but not living in the moment is quite difficult as well, because you want to appreciate what's going on now in your life and you want to be mindful of how you're feeling and what you're going through now, and not only think of the future and planning and sort of getting to a place. So I think both would be a lot healthier in terms of mental and psychological well-being.
Yeah. Another message from Shan, who says, I will slow down about my life, career ambition, and will stay close to my family. I know I have a long way to go. That's good to know. Don't be complacent. Take risks. That's kind of the opposite, though. Take risks when you're younger. But it was interesting, something that you said, Keith, was that you have a life of experience to fall back on when you're older. So I think you do feel perhaps less nervous, less anxious about, you know, certain things that might crop up in your life, because you have that experience that you can fall back on.
Yeah, I think, like, when you're 20, everything's a bit, you know, you don't know what the future holds, so you're just going to hopefully live in the moment and hopefully prepare as best you can in sort of whatever system you're in, whether you're in education or whether you're in the workforce. But then as you start to get a bit older, you know, more and more stress comes in your way. And when you perceive a certain stress, if you have something that's happened to you in the past where you've gone through an adversity and you've survived it and you've done okay, that impending kind of stress in the future is not going to seem so daunting. Mm. So I think you only get that really when you have years under your belt, that you know, like, whatever happened in the past, it, it didn't break me, it didn't end me. I didn't, as long as you sort of, I would look at it like this, like my, the advice I give, I didn't have an answer earlier, but the advice I'd give to myself at 20 now is, don't be so anxious about things. Don't be so worried when stuff is potentially going to go wrong, because you're going to find a way through it. Like, whether you surround yourself with people who can help you, or whether you just do it yourself. And then just, when you, it's okay to make mistakes. When you do make mistakes, just be really honest about the mistake you made.
Yeah.
And then just take it on the chin and just don't let it happen again.
It's easy to say that now, isn't it?
Yeah, looking back, it is, yeah.
But do you feel that now? Do you feel you can actually do that? Or is there still anxieties there? I think anxiety is not necessarily a bad thing, is it? I mean, it's okay to worry and have some anxieties.
Yeah, I mean,
because they can be a driving force, I think, as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like, an anxiety is sort of a fear of what's potentially going to go wrong in the future. So you should take action to avoid the risk potentially. But if you get over anxious, you can really, you'll probably know more than me. Maybe I'm stepping out of my lane here by speaking about this.
Well, you can speak for yourself. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've made mistakes and learned hard lessons, you know, like anybody. But it's about trying to manage the anxiety first, so that it doesn't steer you on the wrong track, and you don't make silly choices.
Mm. Yeah. Dr. Thrayer, I mean, what do you think? Is anxiety, you know, is anxiety some of it a good thing to have?
Well, you know, in general, stress is not always a bad thing. And when you stress, like Keith was mentioning, stress can actually motivate you in certain ways. It can promote certain things. But when it becomes what we call anxiety is where it becomes dysfunctional. So it's just more the word itself is more of a, it signifies, especially clinically, it signifies something that is more dysfunctional. So this is where, like, you can't stop worrying about something no matter how much you try. It really affects you, affects your health. It affects the way you breathe, the way you eat, the way you sleep. So that kind of anxiety is always bad for you.
Sure.
However,
yeah.
But the stress that could lead to anxiety is definitely not always bad for you. I mean, stress can actually be extremely good for you if it's managed properly, if you fall back on your experiences, if you look at how you can be more resilient and more are better, at least able to look at it from a different perspective. So definitely stress can be motivational, but stress that isn't handled properly can turn into anxiety.
Yeah, sure. Loads more messages. I'd love to read some more out if I may. Nijesh says, in my 20s, I will tell myself to respect the elders and not ignore their advice, and take life easy and not to run after anything. Take life easy. Yep. To my 20-year-old self, this is from Saba. Marry young, have kids young, make time for what you love to do. I know you have a job to keep and a career to make, but work and family need to progress side by side. You can't keep one on hold while you excel in the other. That's interesting advice, I think. And it was a little bit much, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about what the nurses were saying, that all these various different people had said, that every single one of them had said, I wish I'd spent more time with my family. You know, instead of thinking, I've just got to get through these last, you know, these years of work, and then we can be a family together, you know, but work is the priority right now. And then we'll spend more time as a family later. And they all regretted it, every single one of them. It's quite interesting. Loads more. Relax, don't rush. So a lot of them, everyone's just saying, yeah, just chill. I wonder if they would be where we are today if we did do that, though.
Well, I think that's because they know now that they have got the toolkit at our age to get through things that they didn't back then, whereas back then it was a daunting task, or it was a daunting feat to get through university, or to move across the world to another country. But when you do it and you realize, you know, it wasn't that bad. Mm. What was I worried about? But at that age, you didn't know.
No, you didn't know that, exactly.
Yeah. And I think a big part of that is the fear of the unknown. Like, you don't really, you're so worried about what could happen that you don't actually realize that you have a lot more tools on your tool belt, like you were saying, Keith, about that you could actually use when you're in that situation.
So do we tell, I mean, I had children, you know, you can actually sort of try to pass on that advice. And I'm sure my parents told me the same thing. So I always remember my mom saying, oh, you know, don't worry about it, don't worry. We still do, don't we? And I'm sure you do in your day-to-day life with your various different clients. You must say on many occasions, you know, don't worry, it will be fine.
Well, actually, you know, that's the first thing I don't tell my
Well,
clients.
Yeah, they probably don't want to hear that, do they? But I mean, you know, essentially in a different way around, that is that kind of advice that you would give.
Yeah, I mean, what I try to educate individuals on is the idea of, you can worry, but there's a point where you need to tell yourself, how much is this worrying actually changing anything? So it's not about not worrying. It's about creating a functional type of worrying. So, for instance, you can't tell a mother not to worry about her children, can you? I mean, it's very difficult for a mother to stop worrying. But you can tell her that at what point does your worrying now turn into something that's affecting not only you, but also your relationship with your child? And is that actually even functional? So it's about just reframing the worrying into something where you're looking at it from a perspective of, yes, this is functional for me. This is going to help me if I worry about this versus, this is going to really hurt me, or it's not really doing any difference anyways. Because to really just say, don't worry about anything in life is quite unrealistic as well, because there are some things you need to think of and you need to consider and you need to worry about. But when that turns into like dysfunctional anxiety, that's where you know that, okay, I need to change strategies at this point.
Yeah. Let's just go through to more of these before we carry on. But from Brian, he says, I would tell myself to start investing. That's only again with hindsight though, isn't it? About buying Bitcoin or investing or saving more money. Or Darren says, be present, enjoy the moments, save for the future. And let's see if we've got some more here. Buy property. Yeah, I wish I'd bought property, but I didn't have the money to buy property. It's easier to say that now, isn't it? You know, save, enjoy every moment, be grateful for every day. That's from Drupa. And Nasir says, guys, oh no, we haven't announced the winner yet. Nope. Keep, if Nasir Ali is still listening, keep your message coming through on 4001 if you want to win Taste of Dubai tickets. What else? This is a really interesting question, I think, for you, Dr. Thraya, from Alistair, who says, are there any medications that are effective for reducing anxiety?
Absolutely. There are many different types of medications. Now, unfortunately, most people hear of the medications that are benzodiazepines, which are the ones that, like, people hear about them, like Xanax, for instance, and they get very worried about them because they're quite addictive, and not in the sense that you can't stop them, but it's just the person gets so used to them, and because they work so well, the person tries to live their life with that kind of a medication. But thankfully, there are a lot more medications that are not benzodiazepines that are used for treating anxiety that are not addictive, and people do not depend on them.
Yeah. Which are such as what? I mean, I'm presuming also that's not obviously the first port of call, is it? I mean, you'd have treatment first before you would actually give medication?
Well, you know, it depends. It depends on the individual. So some individuals really want to start the medication route before they try therapy, and some individuals will never touch the medication and will prefer therapy. So it really just depends on the individual. What we know is it also makes a big difference about the severity of the anxiety. So for some individuals, when they have very severe generalized anxiety disorder, for instance, usually therapy doesn't work really well in the beginning. It's good to do them concurrently, so medication and therapy. But when it's mild anxiety or moderate anxiety, we can definitely start with the therapy and think about medical treatment a little bit later. Mm. But things like from a medical side, now antidepressants are usually used, because the reality is that generalized anxiety disorder and depressive disorders are quite concurrent with each other. So they occur hand in hand. And if you really think about it, it's quite logical as well, because usually if a person is consistently worried all the time, they might set themselves to feeling consistently depressed, in depressed states, and their physical being is affected, their sleep patterns are affected, so it's almost like a loop that they can't get out of. So there's a lot of antidepressants that work on anxiety as well as depression.
And what sort of percentage are you seeing of those people that might start taking medications to actually come off them? Is that, well, that's the end goal, isn't it?
Well, of course. I mean, in general, medications are not given with the hopes or even the thought process of you'll be taking them for the rest of your life. I mean, generally, the rule for psychotropic medications are you start for only 6 months. And most of these medications take about 4 to 6 weeks before they kick in anyways. So really, you're only taking it for about 4.5 months, and then you wean off the medication. And then if your anxiety comes back and the same intensity, then we talk about giving the medication for about a year. Mm. And then after you wean off, if the anxiety comes back, then we talk about maybe lifelong medications. So it's not, the point and the goal is definitely not to stay on the medication unless we're talking about something that's a lot more serious and a lot more severe.
Yeah, loads more come through. Thanks, everybody. Kenneth sent something lovely and saying, use your body when it's strong and young to achieve things you won't be able to later in life. Very true. And I was talking earlier to Keith, and you were saying, I was saying, you know, what are some of the key questions that you ask your new clients? And is age, you know, one of the first things that you say? And you said something really interesting, that one question that you asked everybody. Can you tell us what that was?
Yeah, so that's not so much in the very first thing, but it comes up a lot, is sort of, what age would you be if you didn't know how old you were?
I've got no idea how to answer that, actually. So what would your answer be?
I don't know how old you are, actually, so you can say anything. I'm 32. I have the luxury of like being able to exercise frequently because we work in a gym. So I would say I don't feel 32. I probably feel a little bit younger until I get a little bit of hurty back pain or my knee hurts, and then I feel 90. Like, but
no one knows. I was saying, no one actually knows how you're supposed to feel when you're 30 or 40. You just feel how you feel. Because you're going to compare yourself with others around you who, again, feel differently. So it's quite hard. There's no sort of real set, you know, way of feeling at that age.
Like, there's no
expectations.
There's no image of your perfect 45-year-old.
Yeah.
But if you were to introduce your friend to somebody, and afterwards they think, you know, how old is that person? 45. Oh, 45. You know, they look 30. Or 45, God, they look 55.
Which, like, is not what you want to hear.
Yeah, but that's a case of, like, there's chronological age, as in how long has it been since you were born, and then there's your physiological age. And this is what I tell a lot of people, like, you might be the type of person who's slim genetically, and you don't need to exercise, and you don't really need to eat well, and you're in your early 30s. But what happens when you're 40? Your body's, you're not feeding your body any sort of nutrients through movement or through through food. So when you're 40, you're going to be maybe 45, 50. When you're 50, you're going to be 60 physiologically. When you're 60, you're going to be 75. And that, what kind of quality of life are you going to have then? As opposed to, like, preparing for that now. It's kind of what we were talking about earlier, like looking forward to the future. People do look forward to in the short term, and look, I don't want to eat those foods because I'm going to get fatter, I'm going to put on weight or whatever, like in the next 2 months. But am I going to commit to a year of yoga classes because I don't want to have this back pain get worse in the next 10 years? Or in 10 years' time, I want to be able to play with my kids.
Yeah. They're drivers, aren't they? They're motivators. And I think one of them, when you're getting older, is kids. You know, I want to be able to kick a football around with my kids when I'm a bit older, or go for walks, or go for cycle rides. So, you know, I have to do it now. Do you find a lot of people come to you and they've kind of got panicked and they're like, I've got to get fit, I've got to do it now? Is there still that sense of, you know, I haven't got time, I need to do it now because I've not done it, and I'm now in my 40s and now I'm sort of getting worried?
Yeah, I think there is an element of that. Particularly, I work with kind of rehab, so I get people who've broken at some point, like some injury, and they were playing tennis and now their shoulder's sore, now they can't play tennis, so they haven't got any release during the week and they just want to get back to playing tennis, and didn't realize how long a process it was going to be. They thought they would just go to the physio, do 10 sessions and then they'd be back, but oh yeah, I'm a little bit older, I didn't realize the process. I think people are aware that the older you get, the more difficult it is to change your physiology, to make yourself lose weight, to make yourself get stronger, to get back to playing what the sport you used to do. And that could be an aversion for a lot of people. It's like, the older I get, the higher that mountain gets, because it's a steeper climb to ever get back to where I was, because in your mind you're thinking about to where you were.
You're still young, you've not reached that point yet, Keith.
No, but I see it a lot. I see it with people, and they're afraid to come into a gym, for example, because their perception of a gym is heavy weights, young people, half naked people with muscles. Like, they're not that, so why would they ever go near a gym? That's part of the big mountain that they face when they want to just get back from their sedentary lifestyle. Look, I just want to be able to move, my back is sore, I can't get in and out of the car. So what I see is it's like managing people's expectations. First of all, like, we don't need you to go anywhere near those weights. We just need you to move, first of all. We just need to move, put your body through different dimensions. I'm not talking about like this crazy, fancy movement patterns that you see on Instagram. It's just like, we just need you to go forward and back, up and down, and rotate. And how can we improve that? And then you're improving their neurological system and their coordination, which is enough to, it's like a big win for people. And they've not really touched the weight, they've not really gone through that physical pain that you kind of associate. If I go to the gym, I'm going to be in pain for 4 days after the gym, because that's what people think. Like,
really?
That's what I get. It's like, I'm afraid to come to the gym because you know, I have to do things in my week, I don't want to be in agony. And all they're seeing on Instagram or on YouTube or on TV is these young, fit boot camp, military, push, push, push. And that's the last thing like an older person wants to have to deal with.
That's quite sad, actually, that you see so many people with those associations, that they feel that exercise is pain, that it's like, you know, really tough. And, you know, when exercise, I don't know, for me personally, it's fun. I enjoy it. And then it's there should be, you know, maybe there's too much social media out there with negative connotations. I don't know. Do you think there should be more positive connections with between exercising and
I think
healthy lifestyles?
No, I think it's good to have it all out there because it sort of puts a subliminal effect that, look, people need to stay healthy. We can't all have, like, fast food and stuff being pushed. But there's an element of a facade that's happening online is where people see the young guys, they see the models, they see the top level, like, in shape. That's not how you would, that's not how I would train somebody coming from a desk who wants to get fit again. Mm. Like, we're not gonna hammer you at weights. We're just gonna take your body and start moving your body so at your weight you can get control of the movement patterns that you have to go through. So I think maybe there just needs to be a bit more
reality.
Honest. Yeah, because the other thing is people might not consider themselves injured, but beyond a certain time in their life, everybody has a pain or everybody has a niggle or something that's hurting them. So you can, from what I see, is like everyone comes, no, I'm not injured. We get into the gym, we do some things, like, oh, I can't do that, my knee. Okay, fine. So now we'll just tailor the program around that knee. We have to fix that knee before you can move yourself into a training zone, before you can push your heart rate high enough to lose weight. So let me focus on the knee. And now we're doing rehab, but under the guise of just sort of, it's not rehab because you didn't just twist your knee. This is a pain from 10 years ago that you've never addressed. So while people aren't injured so much, they are, they do have like a pain somewhere that needs to be addressed. Yep. And that's enough in the back of their mind where they don't go and exercise.
Right.
As soon as I exercise, I might go 2 or 3 weeks with the guys and then my back hurts again.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the point?
Yeah.
And then they start that cycle of all negative habits.
Yeah. So fix the pain first and then you can progress slowly.
Or work at, that's one definitely one way. Or just work at a threshold that's way below what you think you need to work at. Because you're still going to get a lot of benefits from just moving and walking and yoga and these things where you're not. Mm. There's no load, there's no impact, but treating your brain through movement, the neurological pathways, it's going to improve everything slowly, but you're going to really feel it quite quickly.
It's interesting, that goes back to what you were saying earlier, Dr. Thraya, about acceptance, isn't it? Let me just reintroduce our guest joining us here, Dr. Thraya Kanafani, who's clinical director, clinical psychologist, and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Dr. Thraya, how are you doing?
Good.
How are you feeling?
A little bit better.
Oh. All this talk of exercise, though, I'm not sure, is it making you feel a bit achy?
It's making me feel like I should probably exercise a little bit more.
Well, you've got Keith here, Keith O'Malley-Farrell, who's talking to us as well from the physical training company. We've been asking you your thoughts on what would you say, or what advice would you give your 20-year-old self? We have some wonderful thoughts and comments coming through. Do keep them coming on 4001. Zafar has just texted in saying, I'm 45 and keep getting told, no, you look younger. That's nice, isn't it? I rarely exercise, looking forward to starting though, but eat a balanced diet, always remain positive and happy. That's perhaps my secret. I think there's definitely truth in that, don't you, Dr. Thraya? It's a positive mental attitude can keep you younger.
I think that's a very big part of it, absolutely. And, you know, the healthy diet is important. Exercise is also important. But I think the word exercise kind of scares people. Keith was talking about it a little bit before about the idea of, like, the gym and barbells and things like that, whereas exercise could be anything, because even for us as psychologists, we promote the idea of exercise when it comes to things like anxiety and depression. We say just 10 or 15 minutes a day of cardio is enough to just, you know, work through all of those neurotransmitters that are in depletion when we talk about things like anxiety and depression. And so exercise, eating healthy, sleeping well, breathing well, so all of those things we promote as a way to live a mentally healthy life as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's scientifically proven, isn't it, that exercise is a physiological thing as well, releases endorphins and various different things. It actually can improve your mental well-being.
Absolutely. I mean, like I was mentioning before, 10 to 15 minutes of cardio for us a day can actually help every person's mental health. And that could be done anyway. I usually promote mothers to dance with their kids at home, you know, or I tell them, like, do jumping jacks with your kids at home, or like when you're at the mall, don't window shop, walk faster. So it's like, you know, it could be absolutely anything. Take a walk with your husband outside, or for people who tend to have very sedentary lifestyles, so they work behind a desk all the time, I say park your car very far, and then when you're walking to and from your office, at least walk faster, or like take a run around, do it twice. You know, so it's about getting out out of the habit that we usually have, which is, especially in a country or a city like Dubai, you know, because everybody's lifestyle is so fast-paced, we tend to, you know, go from house to work. So you sleep, you wake up, you get yourself ready, you go to work, you sit down, you work, and then you leave your work, you get into the car, and you're sitting down, you
it's
go back up.
It's quite frightening, actually. If you look at the Fitbits, a lot of people got Fitbits these days, and they, if you look at how much actual walking you do, aside from any kind of exercise, you're absolutely right. I mean, you get up, you walk to the bathroom, you walk to the kitchen, you walk to your car, you walk to your office. And that's, you know, that's pretty much it. Unless you go out for lunch or something, when even most people get deliveries in, then you walk to your car and you walk home. And in one day, it's minimal. I'd say a few hundred steps, possibly.
Right.
Whereas I'd say in other cities around the world, which are perhaps less sedentary, you're doing on average 5,000 to 10,000 steps without actually doing any exercise at all.
And you don't even feel it. That's the difference, because it becomes part of your lifestyle. So especially cities that are very much walking cities. So cities where you have to walk to work or take a metro and then walk quite a bit or walk to the bus station or things like that. It actually gets you moving. But Dubai is amazingly convenient, but sometimes that could be very detrimental to our physical as well as mental health.
Mm. Yeah, like not only are we not walking, but we're also sitting, static, not moving. And one of the main kind of principles of growth is that your body's going to adapt to whatever demand you put on it. So if the only demand you put on it is for it to stay still and sit and not move, it's going to have a detrimental effect on your posture. Having a poor posture makes exercise way harder.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not only that you're not just getting away with it if you're not walking or if you're not actually, you're actually making yourself worse. Like, you're going backwards. You're making it more difficult when you need to then start exercising. So that, you know, you just have to start as soon as possible and just get moving.
Get moving. Yeah. Like that. Nice message come through, Kareem, saying, this is Kareem. I would tell my 20-year-old, do not worry. You don't know what you don't know. Philosophical. It's true, though. There's no point worrying about something you don't know, is there really? Failures could be the best thing that could happen to you, which is true.
I definitely agree with that, because what ends up happening, especially nowadays, you'll see a lot of parents protecting their kids from failures. You know, they always want them to succeed, and they push them in a way where they do end up succeeding a lot of the time. The problem with that is that when you don't know what it feels like to fail, you don't know how to learn to bounce back. And that resilience is so important in order for you to be able to move throughout life, because you're not going to be able to succeed at everything in your life.
Mm. Yeah, I've made some big mistakes and learned some pretty tough lessons. And that's how now moving forward, I know A, what exactly to avoid. And then if it does go wrong again, or if something goes wrong, I know I've got the mental resolve to be able to pull through it. It's not going to be the end of the world.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much for that. Just moving on a little bit and talking about getting old and super ages. There was an interesting article I read about scientists unravel the secrets of super ages. You know, everyone's saying, you know, 50 is the new 30 or 60. You know, we're all going to be working longer. The retirement age will be in the 70s as opposed to the 50s and 60s. We're living to 80, 90, possibly, you know, the next generation are going to be living to their hundreds. How do you see old age then? Is it something to worry about? Is it something? I must say, actually, I was just on a plane recently, and there was a whole series of documentaries on Emirates. It's quite interesting about aging and about what the future holds for older people. And all they were speculating about the future technologies of sort of micro robots that could be, go into your body and fix your organs. There was also talking about brain transplantation into a new body. So you'd basically have a robotic body that looks exactly like a human body. But you'd retain your brain and your thoughts and your memories and all these sorts of things. And there was sort of a small documentary about it, and a couple saying, you know, why don't we do it? Then we can be together for the rest of our lives. And I was thinking, oh gosh, I'm not sure if I'm certainly not of the generation that's ready for that. Maybe the next generation or the one after. But, you know, it's about living to a good old age, but also, you know, dying in a good way, which I think is as important. We might be able to, you know, cure diseases or make it a little less hard. But, I mean, you know, you want to have a good quality of life up until the point that you die. There's no point prolonging life, is there, unless you can actually enjoy it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have an aversion to being like, oh, I'd never want to be 80 or 85. I mean, what quality of life would I have then? Because you have an image of an older person, not so mobile, not so functional, a little bit less reliant on other people. Whereas now you've got the power and the ability to make that to prevent that from happening to yourself. Mm. Like, it is about the quality, that saying, it's not about the life, the years of your life, but the life in your years, or one of the, or something along those lines.
Okay.
But it's just about the quality of the time you spend here, like, by being healthy, by being moving. So when you are older, you're not, like, when, like I said, when you're 40, you're not 55 internally.
Yeah, exactly. They say that what we really want is our health expectancy to be as close as possible to our life expectancy, so that we live long and die quickly. Which I think is probably the best way, isn't it?
Well, I think so, because, you know, I think most people that are worried about dying or getting older, they have this sort of existential crisis that they fear the idea of not existing anymore. And they fear the idea of the finality of death. And what they don't realize is that when your focus is so much on when or how you're going to die, you forget how to actually enjoy the life that you have now.
Yeah.
And your focus then, when you shift that focus to how you're living now, then you start to think of the benefits of things like physical activity, mental health, you know, spending time with loved ones, social interactions, those kind of things. You no longer have the anxiety of what's to come, rather than what is now, and let me enjoy what is at this moment.
Mm. Well, I'm just conscious of time, and I know we're going to go to a break in just a short while, but there was something else that you spoke about earlier, Dr. Thuraya, and that was about menopause. And it's something we hadn't really talked about, I've not really even read about, was the male menopause. Does it exist?
Yes, it does. It's actually called andropause. And what most people don't recognize is that, you know how women are famously known for the time of the month that they usually, that men will usually use against them when there's a mood swing. Ironically, men actually go through the same hormonal changes
every month.
Yes, there is a slight hormonal shift.
I'm in stage one denial.
So there's a hormonal shift about 2 or 3 days every month for men as well. So this is sort of like the body regulating itself, which is what happens with women. And then at a certain age, when women obviously stop ovulating and stop, basically they go through menopause. And at this and around the same time, men go through what we call andropause, which is the same hormonal changes where their testosterone levels start to slowly decrease year after year. And they go through mood swings. They go through the same kind of, not necessarily the hot flashes and things that women will go through, but they will go through the same mood swings. Their not personality, but sort of characteristics will start altering. So you'll notice that men, usually in their younger years, they'll tend to be a little bit more impatient, but as they get older, they become a little bit more patient, things like that. So so there is the andropause as well as the menopause, which ironically is usually marketed as the midlife crisis, where men buy the Ferrari and date the younger women and things like that. So, but it's very much similar to the experiences that women have hormonally.
I'd like to read a lot more about that. Thanks for bringing that up, Dr. Thuraya. It's really interesting.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.